This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's still August, and it's probably going to be August forever. This week, the president was told he can't buy Greenland. The Danish prime minister called the idea absurd, and the president got mad and canceled a state visit to Denmark because he thought it was so disrespectful of her to say that his idea to buy part of her country was absurd. Trump is still heading to Europe, though, for the G7 meeting of leaders of industrialized nations, and he doesn't get along great with those people either. There had been an effort to keep the most controversial topics off the agenda. They're not even going to produce a communique at the end of the conference saying what they agree on. But now French President Emmanuel Macron says he wants to at least talk about the damaging fires in the Brazilian Amazon as a key focus, which means the president will again be fighting with foreign leaders over climate change. Later in today's show, we'll discuss that and also the disjointed White House response to increasing concerns over the state of the global economy. President Trump said on Twitter on Friday he wants to know who's the bigger enemy, Chairman Xi or Chairman Powell. Yikes. Former Bush administration economic spokesman Tony Fratto will help us walk through those stories in a bit. But now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Rich, what have you been watching this week?
Well, the numbers of Democrats supporting an impeachment inquiry is steadily ticking up and has passed the halfway mark. I think my prediction at the beginning of the year is that Democrats crab walk their way into impeachment. This would be consistent with that, but I think the pace is too slow. At this rate, they'll impeach him, you know, in July of 2020. And unless there's a real dam break and that you pass some event horizon where just all Democrats say, okay, we're going to do this, and most importantly, Nancy Pelosi says, we're going to do this, I think it's a drip-drip probably leading to nowhere.
Felicia, what do you make of that? I always find it hard to think about how to think about these sorts of whip counts, because there are a lot of these situations where it helps you as an individual member to go out and say to your primary voters and your base and your donors, well, gee, I really want to do this, when you know it's not your decision, and you can basically say yes and hope no. So do you think that this is a truly meaningful critical mass now with 130 Democrats in the House saying that they're for impeachment? Is this going to lead in some way to an impeachment?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we saw this headline this week is because Ben Ray Lujan, who's the fourth ranking member of the House Democratic leadership, came out in support. And, you know, I really get why individual members come to this. The Mueller report, as I've said before on this show, was pretty damning with regard to the intent to obstruct justice. And Lujan cited the lack of movement on Russian interference in the upcoming election as one of his real reasons. But, you know, whether this ends up actually being the formal decision of leadership remains a long shot. I agree with that.
But Lujan is an interesting example there because, as you note, he's the fourth ranking member of the House, but he wants to run for the Senate from New Mexico. And so he's out there. He's going to face primary voters in a Senate campaign. So he has that political impulse to be out there saying he's for impeachment. That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to actually do anything that causes impeachment to happen.
Like I said, he did use the opportunity to talk about the potential for Russian interference in 2020. But politics are also politics.
Do we think – I think my view as of a couple of months ago had been that it was probably – a very mildly negative political move for Democrats if they were to impeach the president. That basically at the time, polling on impeachment was underwater. The public did not want it overall. I don't think that it would be as, you know, defining an issue of the 2020 campaign as some people have been suggesting. Is that still the correct evaluation, or have attitudes hardened a little bit to the point where, you know, an unpopular president, it would actually be fine or even politically advantageous to impeach?
I still think it's an opportunity cost. Just it seems to me just obvious if you have a bunch of positions that are above 50% and then you double down on the one that's below 50%, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But the Clinton analogy, where it was actually the initial scandal's popularity went up, but it continued to go up during impeachment, probably doesn't imply, because this president's popularity is not going to soar in any circumstance. And also, the news cycle is so insane, they'd impeach him and it would be like an 18-hour event, probably.
Felicia?
You know, I think whether we're talking about impeachment or the election, most progressives that I talk to are really focused on not just how we no longer have a President Trump, but what we do once he is gone. So everybody I know is talking about the agenda that captures people's imaginations. You know, Bernie Sanders yesterday put out a very big Green New Deal plan. He actually called it a Green New Deal plan. It was $16 trillion. So everyone in my world is talking about that. That's what we're focused on.
One thing I found remarkable this week was the president saying that Jews who vote for Democrats are disloyal, and then clarifying that no, what he really meant was that they were being disloyal to Israel by voting for Democrats who he sees as not being sufficiently pro-Israel. It reminds me of something that the journalist Yair Rosenberg said on this show about a year ago when we had him on, which is the president buys into a lot of these anti-Semitic tropes about dual loyalty, about greed and a focus on money, but he thinks that they are compliments. I think he looks at the idea of dual loyalty to Israel and sees that as some sort of like desirable ethno-nationalistic solidarity. And so it gets him out there saying these things that are offensive and that I think are, you know, are risky for Jews in the American discourse. I don't think you want these anti-Semitic stereotypes to be popularized, even by someone who thinks he is being nice by doing that. And Rich, what have you, obviously Republicans have been complaining a lot over the last few weeks about comments that Ilhan Omar has made, associations that they have had, this group that was going to bring the Omar right. and Rashida Tlaib on that trip to the West Bank. Isn't this something that we're now seeing on the Republican side as well, that the president buys into a lot of these things that you're really not supposed to think or say?
Well, I think our prior guest characterized them as kind of philo-Semitic stereotypes. So they're not meant maliciously, but if you follow the string down, they take you to a bad place. And first of all, obviously a president should not be talking about in these terms about anyone, any group, in any circumstance. And it was just his way of saying the Democratic Party is swinging the wrong way on these issues, that Tlaib and Omar are way out there, which they are, but he put it in disturbing terms.
Felicia?
Well, you know, I think he's also trying to, the president is also trying to use this as a wedge issue. And I think it's fundamentally misguided. I mean, the idea that American Jews don't have a range of interests in addition to Israel, climate. Many Jews I know are concerned about rising white nationalism and anti-Semitism. So the whole effort seems ludicrous. And I'd also point out that, you know, American Jews voted 71% for Hillary Clinton. And in the midterms, that number went up almost 10 points. It was closer to 80%. So if what Trump thinks he's doing here is trying to peel off Jewish voters, I think it's going to be really tough sledding.
It reminds me of the way the president talks about black voters, which is to say it's making a judgment about what a particular voter group ought to care about, ought to vote on. When he talks about black voters, he goes out and talks about, you know, unemployment is so low, it's so low for African Americans, you know, I've done all these things for you, you should support me because of that. Or I brought ASAP Rocky back from Sweden, and at least the implication is, you know, you should vote for me because of that. Similarly, I think the idea is that Jewish voters ought to care primarily about Israel, it sort of doesn't engage with the idea that, first of all, people, Felicia, as you know, might have a variety of interests, but also that, like, when you're outside a group, you might also reflect on the fact that you can't just do introspection and figure out what people in that group are going to care about or ought to care about. It's worth thinking about, you know, what are the observed preferences of this demographic group of voters? What do I have to offer them on that? And what do, you know, take their values as they are, rather than trying to tell them what values they ought to have.
Yeah, I think it was Irving Kristol who had the quip that probably be offensive in today's terms, maybe he wouldn't say, but that Jews have the standard of living of Episcopalians, but vote like Puerto Ricans. And it's just it goes to the point that economics and other factors are not necessarily as important as kind of deeply felt values and cultural predilections. And breaking that is a really hard nut to crack, and you just can't be more pro-Israel than the other side, which the Republicans have established over the last 20 years or so.
I mean, this is also the way the Republicans talk about Asian Americans. That, you know, you have, I mean, obviously it varies based on ethnicity, but you have a lot of Asian American ethnic groups that have relatively high incomes. Basically, you know, well, why don't they vote like white voters who look demographically similar, and sort of a lack of introspection about that?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting question, Josh, but about 6-8 months ago, the polling group Asian American Decisions actually came out with some numbers showing that Asian Americans, despite the high income numbers, Asian Americans, we actually are very progressive, not only with respect to sort of cultural issues, but also with respect to economic issues. So you're right.
Felicia, what have you been watching this week?
I have been looking at the president flip-flopping on gun safety, on background checks. But I wanted to bring it up here not because of the flip-flopping per se. I wanted to point out that the media's focus on that back and forth actually takes us away from what was behind the El Paso shooting more fundamentally, which was this toxic mix of white supremacy, unstable individuals, and access to guns. I mean, on the flip-flopping, I would totally expect that. It's like Charlie Brown in the football. I mean, we should not look to this president for any leadership on that issue. But I think we should still talk about the president's rhetoric about invasion, which he has used close to 24 times in speeches in the past year. Let's look at the 2,000 Facebook ads, which were bought by the Trump campaign, that talk about an invasion of illegals at the southern border. I mean, this is dangerous, and it's not just El Paso, it's Pittsburgh, and it's not just domestic. It's Christchurch, and it's the mosque shooting in Norway. So I think this should remain front and center in our political dialogue.
Rich, 2 weeks ago on this show, we were talking about the president being out there saying that he wanted to do something on background checks. You had some conversations between people in the White House and Senator Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, and Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, who had this background check bill that had failed a few years ago. And they were at least sending signals like that they were open to doing something legislatively that they weren't before. Then you had this phone call between the president and Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, where he seems to have cooled off. But then, you know, Felicia references the flip-flop. There have actually been a couple of flip-flops. Now you have the White House out there saying, well, maybe we are interested in doing something. Do you have a sense of where that stands and what the president's genuine intentions are here?
I'm very skeptical that anything will happen. And I think, you know, we've been down here before, and what happens is he spouts off about this, and then someone tells him, you know, maybe it's Wayne LaPierre, maybe someone else, that, look, it wouldn't make a difference, and it's potentially really harmful to you politically. And then he's okay, never mind. And I think it's going to end up being a never mind. And I think both of those things are true. I don't think universal background checks affect this problem at all. And it's close to the kind of betrayal that could shake at least some of his supporters.
Felicia, when you talk about focusing on the broader context in which this happens, what are productive things for politicians to do in that area? Because one thing that we heard about out of the White House this week was sort of an effort to almost profile shooters in advance of when they attack, doing like psychographic measures and that sort of thing, which sounds to me like, frankly, a very dangerous thing for the government to be doing, to try to, you know, understand the psychology of people by looking at what they're, you know, what they're saying on social media. They even talked about, you know, functional MRI readouts and things from Apple watches and that sort of thing. I think that obviously there are concerns to have about mental health, and there are concerns to have about ideologies that push people toward violent acts. But you can sometimes sort of venture into this pre-crime area where I think you're likely to get the government doing a lot of things you don't really want.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I was actually not trying to make that point. I was trying to say something incredibly basic, and so basic that, you know, we often don't say it out loud, which is, or maybe we do, but it gets lost in the crazy of this August or this presidency. What I was trying to say is basically the president of the United States should not be talking about invasions at our southern border. And you can't actually excuse him by saying, oh, it's just the president freelancing on Twitter or freelancing, you know, at the mic. You're talking about a re-election campaign that's in part based on this. And I get the politics. I get what his base wants. But, you know, this is dangerous. And that's really what I was trying to focus on. With respect to, you know, the gun reform per se, you know, I would argue that some kind of meaningful gun reform is both good policy and good politics. You can have a back and forth about which kinds of reforms would be the most effective, but, you know, close to 90% of Americans want to close the gun show loophole. You've got close to 60% wanting a ban on the sale of semi-automatic assault guns. So this is something that I think, with the exception of the base and the NRA, would be good politically as well as good policy.
Rich, what do you make of the complaints about the president's use of the word invasion?
It's a word I probably use myself in the past. I try to avoid it because I think it speaks to a hostile intent that's not present among these migrants. But it is a word a lot of restrictionists or people who want a border wall have used. I think drawing a connection from that to, you know, a random shooting at a Walmart. Well, not random, but a shooting that targets people just happen to be shopping at a Walmart is, I just don't see the connection at all.
I do. I don't know what to say about that. And it's, yes, it is about the shooting, but it's also about a general feeling of fear in very many communities in this country. So I guess we can say this, Rich, that we agree that the word invasion in this context, given that we're talking about migrants and mostly people who are escaping some kind of economic or gang persecution, like, we shouldn't be saying this.
I feel like there people have lost this ability to have conversations about, you know, prudential concerns about what one should or shouldn't say. It's not like, you know, we should have a law that you can't describe immigration patterns that you don't like as an invasion. But I think people react so quickly to the idea whenever anyone complains about any piece of rhetoric, like, you know, you're stifling me or you're trying to make it impossible for me to discuss the policy position that I want. And I think there have occasionally been elements like that where people are trying to use language complaints in order to avoid having underlying policy debates. But I think people should be a little more open to the idea that the way they talk about things matters and that often we can find ways to talk about things that are better than the other ways that we might talk about things that lead to less, less social incohesion and in the worst case lead to people to be so enraged that they end up being driven to violence, violent acts that they might not otherwise have committed. Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute to talk about the economy and how angry the president is at two different chairmen. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. The president has two messages he wants you to hear on the economy. One is that it's great. It's the best in the world. The job market has hardly ever been better. He's delivered awesome things, and the fake news media is just talking about recession risks because they want to will a recession into existence to hurt him. His other message is that extraordinary measures are desperately needed to prop the economy up. The Federal Reserve should cut interest rates by a full point, he says, and maybe also restart its quantitative easing program from the aftermath of the financial crisis. These two messages reflect a conundrum. There really are warning signs flashing yellow about the economy, and his political fortunes depend on making sure the economy stays strong enough. But he's concerned if he admits there's trouble on the horizon, or even might be. That could cause public views of the economy to become more negative. So, what can he do? I'm really glad to have Tony Fratto here to talk about that. Tony is a managing partner at Hamilton Place Strategies in Washington, D.C. He was a spokesperson on economic matters at the White House and the Treasury Department during the Bush administration. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Josh.
So before we get into the president's comments on Friday about China and the Fed and into specific ideas that are getting floated out of the White House, can we talk about how a normal administration approaches this sort of situation where the economy is maybe getting worse, but it's not yet clear that it's getting worse?
Yeah, I actually have a lot of sympathy, as you could imagine, having been in that position myself, of having to talk about an economy back in 2007, 2008 that was clearly showing signs of slowing down, but not necessarily clear at that time that we would be in a recession. And, you know, the conundrum for spokespeople at the White House, at Treasury, and even the Fed is to not, inspire market participants to pull back and not make economic decisions because it could be self-fulfilling. So, you know, my sympathy is with having to answer the question of, you know, are you concerned about a recession coming? And if the White House answers that question, of course we're, you know, concerned about a recession and we're paying attention to it. That's the headline all across the country, if not the world. And if they say, what recession? We're not, you know, there's no recession on the horizon. Then they just look aloof and they have a hard time making the case for maybe the kinds of policy changes they would need to try to mitigate an economic downturn.
So what should they be proposing to do right now? I mean, you have the president out there just on Friday escalating the trade war. China announced new tariffs. The president said that he would be announcing a response to it. He said he's ordering U.S. companies to find alternatives to China. The market fell hundreds of points on that statement from the president. It seems like the one policy area most directly in his control is trade policy, where the signals from the market are negative, and the comments from Fed Chairman Jay Powell are that the global trading situation is a drag on the economy. It seems like he would start there.
It is the trade is the one area where he can make a have a real policy impact, and you know he has taken to mostly be jawboning the Fed into being looser on monetary policy. Although we should put this in historical perspective, the Fed has been the interest rates are incredibly low. Historically speaking, they still are accommodative relative to where the economy is right now. But he would like to see more action from the Fed. It is entirely in his hands to do more on the trade front. And in fact, actually, even just encouraging words we've seen over the past few months, if he indicates a softening with the Chinese or the willingness to meet and talk, the market reacts in a very positive way. So it is very much in his hands to do that and to come to some kind of process movement with the Chinese. I think would be very welcome by financial markets and businesses also who have been holding back investment decisions. The other thing is he could do actual other policy changes. He could propose policies. He has tried to do some of that in the past week, but it's clearly these are clearly things that have not been very well thought out. Things like the payroll tax or indexing capital gains. There are very long, legislative trains on those possibilities, and it's Congress is probably not in a mind to move tax legislation right now. The one great irony in this, of course, is that before the midterm elections, the president announced, and we know it wasn't really true at the time, but he announced that they were working on a 10% tax cut. If they had actually been working on a 10% middle class tax cut, as he announced, they might have something ready to go right now that they could that they could move forward. But that sort of evaporated.
Yeah, Felicia, to Tony's point about sort of half-baked policy brainstorming in the White House, the Washington Post had an interesting story this week about what they're talking about. There have been these public comments about, maybe a cut in payroll taxes, and the president keeps changing his mind about whether that's something he's interested in or not. Other ideas, the Post says, have been floated inside the White House are a further reduction in the corporate income tax rate to 15%. The tax law from the end of 2017 cut that rate from 35 down to 21. They've been talking about somehow having a rotating structure for board members on the Federal Reserve so that they wouldn't all get to vote on rates every time, which is not a thing the president can just do. And I can think of some reasons why you wouldn't do that through legislation. They've been talking about a tax on currency transactions that would aim to weaken the U.S. dollar. So it's sort of, it seems like the White House perceives that there's a problem here. They're not even to the point of figuring out what kind of policies they want, let alone a legislative strategy. But a lot of these ideas, especially the corporate tax rate cut, it's like they haven't grokked the idea that there's a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. It seems completely different from the policy conversations you might have if you thought, we might need a fiscal stimulus soon. What can we come up with in a zone of agreement between Democrats and Republicans to get that done?
Right, exactly. With respect to the corporate tax cut, they clearly have not learned their lessons, either politically or with respect to policy. You just mentioned this, Josh. We already saw a cut from the mid-30s to 21. And while we've seen some kind of sugar high, most of that money has been actually used to finance share buybacks. We haven't done anything real in corporate taxes, which would include taking measures to bring some money that is currently offshore back to the United States, some corporate tax revenues. But I also wanted to add something further, which is that a lot of the conversation right now in the media suggests that, the economy's fundamentals are actually strong, but it's just Trump's erratic international behavior and or the trade war that's driving these recession fears. But I would argue that that's not quite right, that the economic fundamentals seem strong, but there's actually a lot of reason to worry. I mean, growth is weaker than anyone in either party might like. Second quarter growth plummeted to close to 2%. you know, we would argue at the Roosevelt Institute that that's because of weak demand. You know, average hours worked in manufacturing in July were at the lowest level since 2011. Monopoly concentration is up. Business investment is down. There's a lot of reason to really worry about this economy. And you're right, Josh, that I think you could get a lot of bipartisan agreement on some kind of stimulus. I just don't think you're going to see leadership on that from this White House.
I mean, Rich, to Felicia's point, one problem with for the president going out there and talking about the need for policies to prop up the economy is that we just had this tax cut. And one of the arguments for the tax cut was supposed to be that it was going to boost the economy. And even the sugar high that Felicia references, we got a revision in statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which sounds like a wonky, dull thing, but basically knocking about 30,000 jobs a month off job growth for the last couple of years. So that still shows significantly positive job growth, but it no longer looks like job growth even necessarily got any better in the aftermath of the tax cut. So if they're going to go back and say we have to cut taxes again, it's basically an admission that this thing we said would boost growth hasn't done anything for growth.
Well, I think a lot of the tax cut, at least on the personal side, doesn't really have a big growth effect. The corporate reforms should have a pro-growth effect over time, all things being equal, but all things are never equal. So it's a little hard to determine the specific effect of that. And at the same time, there's this big tax cut. There are tax increases in the form of tariffs. And the effect of the tariff seems to be pretty severe. And the options here aren't great. I mean, they're talking about unilaterally indexing capital gains. Not clear what the economic effect, how big the economic effect of that would be. Or, importantly, if it's legal. Treasury lawyers, I understand, say it's not legal and wouldn't stand up in court. And are you really going to get the House, you know, to pass a big payroll tax cut? You know, you can't. How are you going to get another corporate tax cut through this Congress? And even if a Republican Congress doing it again, going to that well a second time would be really hard. So you're left with the Fed and jawboning the Fed. Rates, as Tony points out, are really quite low. So you'd be kind of a quantitative easing situation. And I don't think we're there yet. I mean, it's clear that the there's some disturbing numbers in the economy, but incomes are still growing. And that should keep us out of recession, but it might not keep us out of a slowing of growth that makes what would have seen this president's major political selling point in 2020 a little less salient.
Tony, what did you make of what happened on Friday, where basically the Federal Reserve has its annual conference out in Jackson Hole where people get together and they talk about monetary policy and other things the Fed is up to? And Jay Powell, the chairman, gave this anticipated speech that I think basically went as expected, where he described things that are similar to what he said after the last Fed meeting, that were in the notes from that meeting, that there are various things that are weakening the global economic outlook, including the increased tensions about trade globally. And those are factors that sort of push toward a reason for the Fed to think about maybe accommodating some more, doing what he keeps describing as a mid-cycle adjustment. They did this a couple of times in the 1990s where they cut rates three times, even though the economy wasn't going into recession. So that seemed like about as expected. He said things in line with what he said in the past, and the president freaked out and said, well, you know, who's our bigger enemy? Is it Jay Powell or is it Chairman Xi? And then the president announced another round of retaliation toward China, knocking hundreds of points off the stock market. You know, we started the segment talking about, well, the president has control over trade. If he wants the economic outlook to look better, the best thing he can do is try to back off on the trade war. But it looks like when he gets upset, his instinct is to escalate there.
Yeah, that seems to be the direction that he'll just instinctively go. And I don't know who set expectations for the president with Jay Powell's speech, but it seemed like from his tweets before Powell's speech that he had some anticipation that maybe Powell was going to announce some kind of plan to accelerate the mid-cycle adjustment and even indicate bigger cuts to come in the future. So I don't know if that was his own expectations or if one of his economic advisors led him to believe that Powell was going to be there. But his reaction was pretty volatile. Clearly, did not read what Powell was trying to say. One very clear quote in Powell's speech was where he notes that there are, no recent precedents to guide any policy response to the current situation. He's referring to the uncertainty and volatility in the trade situation and how that is a drag on the economy. It is creating enormous uncertainty for not just for investors, but for businesses who are making planning decisions on hiring and investing. And, you know, the idea that they that companies can just sort out new supply chains that have been built up over decades, that they can do that in a short period of time, is not at all realistic. And so it is causing adjustments and very likely, you know, a source of instability for the economy. So on cue, after Chairman Powell's speech, the president was out with, you know, strong criticism of Powell and adding to that uncertainty once again in ways that now I suppose we should expect it now. I think, we treat trade, and even Powell in his speech today talked about trade as a variable factor, things that will go up and down and change. And I think we should maybe rethink that uncertainty in the trade situation should now be considered a constant and probably should be considered a constant by the FOMC.
Felicia, is there an opportunity here for Democrats to sort of seize the narrative on the economy? And I don't mean the sort of long-term restructuring the economy stuff. I mean, to come out right now and say, yes, the economy is at risk of recession because of irresponsible things the president is doing. Here is our package of things that we believe will help stabilize the economy. Let's do an infrastructure package now. They could propose some sort of tax rebate, which I assume they would prefer over a payroll tax cut. That sort of, you know, that would be a rehashing of the fight that we had 10 years ago in the last rescue. Basically being out there and saying, here, we have a short-term plan for what we're going to do to stop the Trump recession from happening. And you'd get one of two things. Either the president would ignore them, and then they can go out on the campaign trail and say, we have a plan, even though he doesn't have a plan. Or he gets desperate, maybe he actually takes them up on it and they can work out, you know, it can finally be infrastructure week. It seems like either way that goes, that would be a win for Democrats.
Right. And I do think that Democrats are actually moving in that direction. Let me just point out one thing about the fundamentals before we think about what Democrats might do in the short to medium term. You know, we say a lot that wage growth is up, especially at the bottom of the income decile, and that is actually true, and that is good. But that basically has only gotten us back to neutral, given where we would have been without the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And I just think you can't overestimate that when you look at our larger politics. You know, with respect to what, you know, Democrats could propose now, I do think some kind of tax rebate would be popular in the medium term. Ultimately, though, I think that Democrats are already on board with higher taxes, especially relative to the 2017 law. So I do think that is, and that obviously takes legislation, but that is where I think the entire party is going to go. I do think that with respect to public spending on some kind of infrastructure that could get us some way towards, you know, a Green New Deal, I think that would be a good part of the package. And then finally, I wanted to point out that many Democrats, and not just those on the, quote, far left, have been talking more and more about unions, right? Beto O'Rourke has come out in favor of wage boards. Pete Buttigieg, who may or may not be a moderate, but he came out with a very strong union package. And this is about helping to ensure better distributed growth. Obviously, Vice President Biden is also a big labor supporter and is supported very much by labor. So I think going back to the union argument and tying that to wages is something that I'm seeing across the range of Democrats.
Rich, aside from the one very obvious suggestion for Republicans in Congress to make, which is stop the trade war, stop causing unnecessary disruptions in the global trading system, what is there for Republicans who aren't the president to propose here? Because I feel like this is always a problem for ideological conservatives at a time when the economy is starting to look weak, that they have this idea that, you know, the government's not supposed to manage the economy. They periodically indicate skepticism about the idea that fiscal stimulus even works to support the economy. So what should Republicans be saying we should do if people are nervous besides don't cause more problems with China?
I think in general, you should advocate policies that are good for economic growth in the long term rather than going for a sugar high in a downturn, unless you're in a real crisis situation, which we were in 08 and 09. But obviously, the trade war is the major problem here. And the problem is the president's not going to back down from it anytime soon. And the Chinese are sensing weakness, which is why what would have been seen by some points of view as a conciliatory move and putting off these consumer-oriented tariffs that were going to come on was read by the Chinese not illegitimately as a sign of weakness and a sign that Trump realized that the tariffs are supposed to be hurting China are also hurting here at a time when our economy may be slowing down. So he lost leverage, and the Chinese are exploiting that at the moment. I still think there is a chance of some minimalist deal to kind of paper over these differences going into 2020, but maybe it's just going to be contention all the way through.
There's another big economic story that I want to address that's also an environmental policy story, which is the Trump administration has proposed to partly roll back auto emissions rules that had been imposed under the Obama administration. Those rules were set to require automakers to gradually but very significantly increase fuel economy through 2025. Ultimately, they were supposed to reach an average of 57.5 miles to the gallon across their car and truck fleets. Instead, the Trump EPA says they will freeze the guideline at just 37 miles to the gallon, and they're proposing to take away states' power to impose their own more stringent rules, which California has done for decades. Now, California says stripping them of that power is illegal. They're fighting Trump's rule in court. And there's a coalition of automakers that's really upset about the uncertainty this creates, about what regulations they're going to operate under, whether they're going to have to sell vehicles for two different internal markets in the U.S. So they've reached an agreement with California to essentially follow the rolled-back Obama rule, even though Trump says they don't have to. That's Honda, Ford, Volkswagen, and BMW. Mercedes-Benz is also about to sign up to this coalition, according to the New York Times. And the Times also reports the president is outraged about this. He believes this plan is going to grow the economy, although Consumer Reports estimates that his approach with lower fuel economy would actually cost consumers thousands of dollars over the life of their cars due to higher fuel consumption. Tony, what do you make of this move? It seems quite unusual for an administration to be out there pushing a deregulation really hard that much of the industry doesn't even seem to want.
Yeah, I think, again, this reflects to some degree the planning and time frames that the companies like automakers are dealing with over time. They have already put in place, you know, factory production, sourcing, design, engineering to be able to produce vehicles that are going to meet these standards. And so to change them on a dime is very difficult for them to adhere to. They also have, I think it's important to remember, these companies are not necessarily opposed to decreasing emissions, increasing emissions requirements for them over time. They may have some concerns over the pace, but they understand that where a lot of their customers are going, that they desire cleaner emission vehicles and even eventually some zero emission, significant amount of zero emission vehicles. The problem also is with the states, right? I mean, there's people who tend to really like states' rights, you know, for issues that they agree with, are okay with this kind of thing. They object when, you know, states like California, which is not just a big state, but one of the biggest states in the world, it would be around the fifth largest economy in the world if it was on its own. It has market power and it's willing to use it. And that's a state's right thing also. So I think we're going to see increasing battles like this. But these are, you know, they're acting in their interests, and the automakers are squeezed.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, in addition to the states' rights issue, a big talking point throughout the Obama administration from Republicans was about policy uncertainty and how, you know, regardless of whether policy changes are good or bad, merely putting out there that we won't know what the policy is going to be is harmful to investment and growth. It seems like here the Trump has disregarded that idea. It's out of I think his sort of, you know, dirty economy ideology that basically, like, you know, extracting fuels out of the ground and doing big heavy things, that's his view of what it means to have a strong and growing economy. And so he's focused on this, I think, not so much from the perspective of the auto industry, but from the oil industry.
Yeah, well, I think he's right about that. I think this country has an enormous wealth that's in the so-called extraction industry and should take advantage of it. The automakers obviously are reacting to the uncertainty. If there's continued litigation between California and the feds over this, they just want some rule that they know they can abide by going forward, as Tony points out. And two, also, it's great politics for these auto companies that can, you know, say now that, you know, they're very serious about addressing climate change and reducing emissions. I'm not sure that consumers are as interested in low emission vehicles. I mean, electric cars have not taken off. People like trucks and SUVs, which is part of the reason that people very concerned about the climate want to use the brute force of regulations to try to chase people out of those cars.
Yeah, although, I mean, Felicia, to Rich's point about SUVs, the Honda CR-V is already set to be well ahead of where these standards are. that's the best-selling SUV on the U.S. market. So I think part of what the auto companies have done is they've been able to simultaneously meet a lot of those consumer demands while meeting or exceeding these standards that are put in place by the government.
Right, and I think that is in part because actually California, which we should talk about, has been able to drive a kind of stability. That's in part because California has been in coalition with a number of other states on car emission standards. My memory is that that coalition represents well over half of the entire domestic auto industry. So that's a big deal. That is something that if I'm an auto executive, I really want. Let me just say one other small thing about California. My memory is that the state legislation that allows California to set its own environmental standards is actually predates the EPA. So it'll be really interesting to see how this whole thing plays out in court. I agree that California does have market power. I agree that California is going to use it. And I think it will be a very interesting thing to watch, given where those politics are.
I've been talking with Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute and Rich Lowry of National Review and Tony Fratto of Hamilton Place Strategies. We will be back to talk about Greenland because it's August. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. And our special guest is Tony Fratto. Tony is managing partner at Hamilton Place Strategies in Washington, D.C., and was an economic spokesman at the White House and the Treasury Department during the Bush administration. So we're not buying Greenland. Helene Olin mentioned this briefly on last week's show when it just seemed like a news of the weird item that Trump had been musing to various associates about buying Greenland, and wasn't that weird? Well, absurd is the word that Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen used for it, and Trump didn't take kindly to that. He canceled a state visit to Denmark that was scheduled for next month on the grounds that you don't talk to the United States like that and say it's absurd when they want to buy part of your country. Trump also complained again about NATO, of which Denmark is a member, pointing out that the Danes have not hit the NATO target of spending 2% of GDP on military and defense. Rich, I've been surprised at the number of conservatives who seem eager to stick up for the Greenland purchase plan. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton is even out there saying it was his idea to buy Greenland.
I think it apparently was his idea. You know, if they're selling, I don't think it'd be a bad idea
but
at all.
But they're not selling. Like, well, you know, that's the fatal flaw in the plan.
That is the fatal flaw. That's why I said if, which they aren't. And, I mean, this is kind of classic Trump controversy, something kind of outlandish idea, sort of amusing and funny on the face of it that spirals into something real. And I don't think we're going to have, you know, a major divorce with Denmark. I think his trip eventually will happen, but this is it's diplomacy like out of a Marx Brothers movie.
So, Tony, I'm trying to think about how to think about Denmark. I mean, this is like with the ASAP Rocky thing. Like, how much does it matter if you offend and alienate Sweden? I mean, it's not China, it's not France, but Denmark, unlike a lot of other European powers, sent troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. They've been one of the European countries that's relatively aligned with us on foreign policy compared to some other European powers. What is the effect when you pick this totally bizarre fight with officials there and alienate people on both sides of the aisle?
Well, hopefully it won't have long-term deterioration. I think it is a durable relationship, and I think, you know, probably in the future we'll probably look back at this as a weird spike in the relationship. But we shouldn't forget, maybe it is like the opportunity to talk about just what a good ally the Danes have been. They did send troops, and Danish troops died in a lot of those battles. So we should consider that. And NATO, there are bigger targets on NATO than the Danes. Even if they did meet their commitment, it wouldn't make a huge difference to the overall budgetary commitment to NATO. But I think they wanted to have that conversation as well. So look, I think over time it's going to be this will be a flash. It'll be a good durable relationship. But this is this will be, you know, one of those pages in the Trump presidency history book when they talk about the weird episodes. This will definitely get his attention for it.
Felicia, one thing that I find remarkable about this episode is why is the Trump administration interested in Greenland? What's the strategic importance of Greenland? It all has to do with climate change. The idea is that as stuff melts up there, you're going to have trading routes through the Arctic that make Greenland important in a way that it didn't used to be. It's the one instance where the Trump administration seems at least implicitly eager to talk about climate change, even when you talk about lower latitudes on the globe, they don't want to talk about it at all.
Right. Undervalued real estate, right?
Right.
Couldn't be more Trumpian. Look, I don't really have a lot to add to what everyone has said here, except, I mean, I agree with respect to the long-term value of the diplomatic relationship. I will point out, however, that, again, maybe this is my week to talk about the words Trump uses, but he called the prime minister's statement nasty, which is a word he likes to use about women. And, you know, no comment.
Well, so let's actually talk about climate change and international relations, because it's going to be on the agenda this week besides the valuation of a Greenland purchase. You have these ongoing fires in the Amazon basin and deforestation of the Amazon, and this poses risks to the climate because those Amazon forests, they suck a lot of carbon dioxide out of the air. And as you have a more right-wing government in Brazil that is more interested in expanding livestock and such uses of the Amazon, there's a risk of how that's going to affect the whole world. Climate. And so as we come up on the G7 meeting, which starts on Saturday in Biarritz in France, French President Emmanuel Macron has said that he wants to make this a key focus of the G7 discussions and what we're going to do about the Amazon specifically and climate change in general. And Tony, I'm wondering about your thoughts on how that's likely to go, because the president has often gotten very upset at these meetings. And there had been talk until a few days ago that they were going to try to avoid controversial subjects, including climate, in an effort to avoid a situation like last time where Trump rips up the communique from the G7 meeting after he leaves.
Well, in the case of in the case of the Amazon forests, in this case, there's nothing to ask not a whole lot to ask directly for the U.S. president to do, and the United States to do. They could support it, and there are some programs out there to do it. We could lend assistance to try to try to halt the burning of the forest. But it goes beyond that in Brazil, the country I spend a lot of time in. Where the policies and in particular the policies of the Bolsonaro administration right now are fairly indifferent to the future of the Amazon. So Macron wants to bring these countries together to try to give some guidance, leadership, and direction. At the same time, the place where you would put words to those efforts in the communique, he has also decided that we're not going to have a communique this year because all we do is fight over the communiques and no one pays a whole lot of attention to them. But if you're going to have some kind of agreement, you need to put it on paper and try to get the countries to join together on it. In the case of Trump, maybe make the case with him, if you want to have vehicles that are emitting carbon, you want something to take carbon out of the air, and it's forests. And I think certainly everyone can agree that that's one way to prevent emissions going into the atmosphere. And most people tend to, in fact, most Republicans that I speak with are very much in favor of doing things like forest protection even with that specific aim. So there may be an opportunity there, and we'll see whether President Macron has any persuasive powers. He hasn't shown that in the past with Trump, but we'll give him a chance here.
Is the solution essentially that we should be paying Brazil to preserve these forests? I mean, if the argument is the Amazon forest is the lungs of the world and is important to the well-being of people all over the globe, and the reasons that Brazil would like to reclaim land in the Amazon have to do with domestic economic development, it seems only fair to say, well, if we're asking the Brazilians to bear the economic burden of not developing that area and, we are wealthier countries than Brazil, it seems like that ought to be on us to pay for.
And we have in the past. I mean, there have been programs of tropical forest preservation that would turn countries, especially poor countries, debt into, forgive that debt, pay off that debt in exchange for protecting some amount of forest. There are efforts to do it. I mean, even if you are Brazil, and a lot of Brazilians certainly feel this way, that it is a resource that they want to have forever, and so you want to maintain it, even regardless of its benefit to the world, which is pretty clear. It's something that they should want to preserve. Even if you had a program of clearing tropical rainforest in Brazil to use for development. And you can argue whether Brazil actually needs more space for agriculture or urban development. It's a very, very big country. They don't necessarily need to take it from the Amazon. The fires that are burning there is a completely different story. That's not those aren't fires for to clear the forest for development. That's, you know, uncontrolled, and it's not clear how that's going to end.
The other big news story about the G7 that we've had in advance of it is the president musing that he would really like Vladimir Putin back at the G7. He thinks it would be appropriate to have him back. Rich, what do you make of that?
I think it's ridiculous. They're booted from the G8 for a good reason, invading a sovereign country and cleaving off part of it and annexing it. And it's just part of Trump's reflex towards wanting to deal with Vladimir Putin. As we talked for years, I don't think there's anything nefarious or conspiratorial about this, but the basic instinct is still blameworthy.
It's a remarkable thing to think about, though, Felicia, because if the president actually followed through on that and got his way, the next meeting is in the United States, the spring or summer of next year, right in the heat of the presidential campaign. That would be President Trump bringing Vladimir Putin to the United States for his reintroduction to this, you know, elite group of global leaders.
Yeah, I can't imagine the politics on that one. But as you suggested, I don't think it's going to happen. I agree with Rich. It is ridiculous. I think it's worth looking at the terms or the bar that Macron has actually set for this summit. You know, he already said there is going to be no final communique. You've got Trump and you've got Boris Johnson, right? Two people who I think some commentators said are, quote, not well known for their self-control, both at this summit for the first time. And so Macron has basically said, we are not going to have any written agreement. He said, quote, we must assume that on one subject or another, a member of the club might not sign up. So you've got a lot of disarray. I mean, Italy's prime minister resigned on Tuesday. Canadians are about to have an election. You know, Merkel's about to, you know, go leave office. So I am just not sure how much you can really expect out of the G7 right now. I will say, however, that if, you know, it can be used to elevate issues like the Brazilian fires, even in sort of a headline basis, then that's a good thing. But I really would, at this juncture in history, not put a lot of stake into what comes out of it.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
It's become conventional wisdom on the left that the United States was literally founded on slavery. We've heard this from Beto O'Rourke. It's a premise of the new New York Times so-called 1619 project focusing on the history of slavery. It's certainly true that founding was tainted by slavery at the beginning. But what we should focus on is what truly made the American founding unique, which wasn't the status of slavery, it was the emphasis on freedom, which was incompletely realized at the beginning, but over time destroyed the slave system of the South.
Felicia Wong, what's your rant?
This week, the powerful Business Roundtable agreed to a new set of principles. Shareholder profit should no longer be the highest purpose of a corporation. Now, this is according to the very top of the business elite, J.P. Morgan Chase, Amazon. These companies say that they should have lots of stakeholders, employees, the larger community, their vendors. So, should we cheer? Maybe, but I'm not cheering yet. Because on the one hand, tossing the doctrine of shareholder primacy to the curb is really important. My colleague Lenore Palladino has pointed out that this theory, quote, obscured the basic standard that employees should do well when their businesses do well. But on the other hand, what did the CEOs propose to exactly do? There are plenty of ideas out there. They could let workers elect board members. They could stop sheltering taxes, some $70 billion annually offshore. Or they could just reverse the Trump tax law, which slashes the corporate tax rate. So the Business Roundtable announcement is a big first step, but I look forward to the rest.
Tony Fratto, what's on your mind?
Josh, America is generally great, but sometimes we're not great at naming things, and you know, especially foods. You know, some of the mistakes in the past, in my opinion, and things like misappropriating geographic names like champagne and Parmesan. These things drive me crazy a little bit. I know they drive the Europeans crazy. Today, it's things like milk that doesn't contain any milk and meat that doesn't contain any meat. look, I'm nothing against the products, but if you're going to invent these things, invent names for them. They deserve their own names, and you should give them their own names.
For my rant, Google has changed its mind about bringing your whole self to work. New employee guidelines from the company say not to spend your work time getting into fights about politics on the company's internal message boards. They also say not to post ad hominem attacks, even against public figures. The James Damore mess wasn't the half of it. Google unwisely spent years encouraging employees to bring freewheeling discussions of politics and values into the office. This led to an unrealistic expectation among employees that their values should be shared among all the people around them and they should hash out whatever disagreements they had about these things. They wanted to fight all the time about politics and also not have to work with people that they disagreed with about politics. Part of sharing a society is not fighting about everything all the time, not hashing out every disagreement, and understanding that we don't need to agree with people on everything all the time, and one way to deal with that is by not discussing everything with everyone all the time. Leave the politics at home. Now at Google, that's an order. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Felicia Wong, and Tony Fratto. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is Kat Yore. Colin Cab Washington is our production assistant. Special thanks to our intern, Gracie Attlee. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.